As an adolescent, Doug Merlino played on an integrated basketball team that was made up of students from the elite private schools in Seattle and players from the predominantly black central area. The boys bonded as teammates but went their separate ways when the team dissolved. Two decades later, Doug sought out his former teammates to see how the experience had affected them later in their lives. His new book, The Hustle, tells that story. It's published by Bloomsbury, and I'm very pleased that it brings him to our show today. Hello.
Hi. Great to be here.
What provoked you to find out what had happened to your teammates?
Well, we'd had this team where we'd played together for a season, and there's a lot of high hopes as far as getting the African-American side opportunities for private school scholarships. And I'd known that this was going on and kind of lost touch with guys from each side of the team. As it happened, 5 years after we played together in the early 90s, I was home from college and picked up the Seattle Times. And on the front page of the Times was an article. The headline was, "What Went Wrong? Terrell Johnson Was Young, Black, Male, and Murdered." He'd actually been a star player on our team, very charismatic guy, very nice. And the photo the paper used was actually an old photo of our integrated basketball team that had been cropped so that only Terrell was left. So this article was organized around Terrell's involvement in our team and talking about various integration programs he'd been in. I think that really planted the seed that I went back, about 10 years later and started looking up the guys.
And he was murdered?
Yeah, he was murdered in a very brutal fashion. He'd been murdered and his legs had been dismembered.
For what reason? Was he involved in any criminal activity? Was this the result of that or just some people being mean?
Well, at the time, the article didn't have any solutions because basically he'd been a nice kid who'd, through high school, started going sideways, had been involved in a little street activity, but nothing serious. And I think as I went back, I discovered what had happened to him.
But do you think the team successfully bridged the black and white divide, or was it just when you were playing together?
In some ways it did, in some ways it didn't.
You ever visit each other, your black teammates' homes?
No, they would come out to our houses. But we were actually never invited or we never went there. And I think that was almost a subconscious thing of it was about bringing these guys out to mix with the private school kids and almost set up that they had everything to gain. But from our side, it was much more fuzzy about what we would have to gain from this.
Although I'm not sure that that was the best thing psychologically for them to see it as, well, we have everything to gain from going to white people's homes.
Yeah, oh, exactly. I mean, I think in some ways it was a pragmatic approach for them and their coach because they knew they might open up some economic opportunities. But it was also, yeah, I think it also kept this dynamic going, even though we weren't quite aware of it at the time.
How long did you play together?
We played together for a season in the AAU league in Washington State. So we traveled around, and that season we actually won the state championship.
Now, if you'd stayed in public school, you probably would have played on an integrated team, but your parents took you out of the public schools?
Yeah, I mean, one thing as I was working on the book, I mean, I went through and realized all the intersecting lines of race and class. For example, my family moved right over the county line when I was a kid. Because that was when busing was happening. They didn't want me to be bused. So in fact, I grew up in an all-white neighborhood and would have missed out on that. And even in the neighborhood I grew up in, then the public schools were completely white.
But your parents sent you to Lakeside, the school that Bill Gates had gone to.
Yeah, I mean, it was a bit of a shocker because coming from my dad owned a coin-operated laundry company. And in the 80s, a school like Lakeside was trying to, I guess you would say, diversify in a way and bring in more kids of backgrounds that weren't from the legal or business professions in Seattle. So in a way, I was kind of an early wave of diversity, and that was a shock for me.
You were integrating the schools as well as a poorer kid.
in a different way, yeah.
Well, I mean, it's interesting what the school cheer was when the basketball team was losing.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was something I discovered after I started going there is that when the high school team was losing, they in the fourth quarter they would chant, "It's all right, it's okay, you all work for us someday at the other side.
Well, I guess those kids were getting the right message. This was the high school team. So were you playing on your high school team as well as on this other team?
No. This was like eighth grade, so middle school. So the school went all the way from fifth grade through high school.
You and Eric, the only black kid in your class, both wound up on the school basketball team.
Yeah, that was in hindsight, that was a place where kids who maybe didn't quite fit in with the social scene kind of found some comfort playing basketball. It was, a lot of the other kids were into sports like crew or lacrosse. And I guess the rest of us played basketball.
But Eric played in a different style from the rest of the kids.
Well, he was much, much better. he was a great basketball player. He was very quick, had great moves to the hoop. And, he was just better.
It was the father of a teammate at Lakeside School who came up with the idea for this integrated team. Who was he, and what was his plan?
So his name was Randy Finley. He'd come up through the '60s and had been somewhat involved in counterculture. He had ended up opening a chain of art house movie theaters in Seattle, and he became kind of a local celebrity. Made some money that way. Had sent his own son to private school, but had very mixed feelings about it. And so when he saw a chance to take some white kids from private school and some black kids from the central area, I think he thought, hey, let's throw these guys together and see where we can go from this.
My guess is Doug Merlino, who has written for Slate, Wired, Men's Journal, Seattle Times, and other publications. His book, The Hustle, One Team and Ten Lives in Black and White, published by Bloomsbury. Well, this was in 1986. Seattle is the home of Microsoft, Starbucks, and some other places. Were they even around at the time?
You know, it was a time that Seattle, I think, along with the rest of the country, was undergoing a massive economic transition. I mean, most of my friends, when I grew up, we all had connections to Boeing. I mean, one way or another, it was this industrial model. And really, that season when we played together in March 86 was when Microsoft launched their IPO. And it's really a start of a transition, I think, in our economy towards this more high-tech type of global work.
How large is the black population in Seattle?
It's about, back in 86, it was a 500,000, about 10% of the population. And now it's about the same, although there's been a mass migration to the south end of the county.
But there was definitely a part of town that was the black community.
Exactly. The central area is right to the east of downtown. It's about 4 square mile area. And when most African Americans came to Seattle in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, they were channeled in because they really couldn't. It was very, very difficult at that time if you were black to buy a house or rent an apartment anywhere else.
Tell us about your coach, Willie McLean.
He's a fascinating guy. He was born in 1953 in Gulfport, Mississippi, as he said, in the old slave quarters, very segregated. His family came to Seattle in 1960 for better economic opportunities. He grew up in the central area, became a sports star, went through black power street riots in 68. After high school, he basically hit a brick wall, went nowhere. In the mid-70s, he started getting his life together, and he kind of found a grounding, I think, one, in the church, and two, in coaching the kids and really mentoring kids.
But mostly black kids. So what was what were his feelings about coaching an integrated team? White kids who, in some cases, did not grow up in a culture where basketball was an important skill to develop.
Yeah, he said he was extremely nervous at first when he brought his guys out to play with us. And, he felt that a lot of eyes of our parents were on him and wondering, as he said, if this, what's up with this black guy and can he coach? So as he said, basically between the lines is where he feels comfortable. So he just got down and taught us basics and really got on us on the court. And he felt that that was his way of, that was where he could focus and show that he was up to the task.
Wasn't he also hoping to get some of the kids, and especially his own son, into private schools?
Exactly. It turned out, very soon after we started, Randy Finley, the white organizer, and him were talking. And, I think Randy saw the lack of opportunities that these guys were going to have. So what he did, what they started talking about was getting them into private schools around Seattle, and they really started to make a concerted effort to talk to administrators and get some of these guys admitted.
But we know that you get a better education at an elite school, and even if you want to do well academically, if you're in some schools like the high school I went to, Eastern District High School in Brooklyn, you're already behind other kids. I'm sure that happened here. What was the situation for some of the black kids in the school? Is it naive to expect that being on an integrated basketball team is going to do all that much for you?
You know, I started out thinking that it was naive, but as I've talked to my black teammates, I mean, they're saying, hey, this was the only chance I had. I mean, this was my one chance, and you know, there wasn't a lot of other opportunities. And, you know, when some of these guys got into private high schools, it came down to a lot of different factors. Some guy, you know, one guy, Damien, who's now a teacher himself, is just kind of stubborn and tough, and he gritted it out. Another guy, John Thompson, he was functionally illiterate. He got into private school, and they were making him read aloud in class, and, you know, he just couldn't handle it. And in the meantime, he realized he could go out on the streets and make $1,500 a day, and that's what he did. So it came down to the individual personalities, but it was very, very hard on them.
You quote Kareem Abdul-Jabbar at the beginning of one chapter, saying that both white and black basketball is, quote, patterned and regimented like the lives awaiting its players. What do you think he meant by that?
Well, what I saw, I mean, the reason I use that quote is that I saw, you know, this private school side had so many structured activities. Besides basketball, there were, you know, guys belong to the tennis club or, you know, could start getting internships in finance even in high school. And basketball was one other structured activity to move them along in life. Whereas for the guys from the central area, basketball team was, as they say, their family and their main activity. And when that ended, there had to be a lot of improvisation because there was not so many outlets to go to. I mean, there's only a few.
At one point in your book, you talk about what boys are supposed to learn from playing on a team. What does playing on a basketball team teach a boy, especially boys who come out of very different senses of what a team might even mean?
Yeah, I mean, I wondered about that whole ideology, and I looked back and discovered there's this idea of muscular Christianity that started here in the 1800s of, you know, you play on a team and it makes you disciplined and work with other boys. And you learn, you know, how to be a man and take care of yourself in society. And, I mean, I think there is something to that. What I found from my teammates is that transitioning, using some of those skills and then transitioning to, say, as one of my teammates did, to Princeton is one thing. But if you're transitioning to no job in the streets, it's very hard to then apply those you know, supposed skills that you learn.
This is something John Updike wrote about in the Rabbit books, but you also discuss a book called Power at Play that talks about what boys get from athletics and how they feel when their involvement ends. You also make the point that boys who choose to play sports tend to be shy and socially incompetent, at least at first. The activity of playing the sport actually changes them, transforms them?
Yeah, it was interesting. I found that research, and really what I found from the team was that it was like Eric and I, who didn't quite fit in at private school, or another guy, John, who, you know, didn't really have a father at home, or Chris, who came from a very prominent family with a lawyer dad. Every guy then got on this team, and it was, you know, the word was family and camaraderie and a place where people felt safe.
And kids had no problems with dealing with racial topics?
You know, we touched on those taboos when we rode around and people made jokes.
Because hip-hop was just emerging at this time.
Yeah, so you know, the black guys all knew Run DMC, LL Cool J, the Fat Boys, and they would rap that. And, you know, they would start getting us to try to beatbox and do other things. And, you know, that... These were these very tenuous connections that started to get made.
Well, it obviously worked, at least for a time, because as you said earlier, you managed an upset victory in the Western Washington Championship. So the team did pretty well after all, at least for the 1 year it was together.
On the court, yeah, on the court.
And then it just dissolved?
It dissolved and went into these efforts to get the guys into private schools.
But nobody tried another team the next year.
No, it started, no.
The Doug Merlino's book, The Hustle, One Team and Ten Lives in Black and White, is published by Bloomsbury. Did any of the black kids go on to great success?
Yeah, I mean, I think the best success is Damien, who went to private school and is now a teacher for 14 years.
Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.
It's been a real pleasure talking with you.